top of the table, that's exciting. Bottom of the table, that's exciting. Like, that's the sort of football that you want to be. And these are the pressure games that in 15, 20 years' time, I will look back on and I will remember these are the important matches for me, not the middle of the table teams.
Subscribe to the Koi Gig podcast stream on the OTB Sports app now.
OTB AM. With Gillette, put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
You know, that wasn't an All-Ireland winning performance.
Probably should have won the game based on the second half performance.
Is it a step too far to say it was the performance so far of the World Cup? Maybe not.
OTBAN's performance rankings with Gillette.
I'm scratching my head. That performance was just lacked that intensity.
Oh, Peter G, sorry about that. No spoiler alert, Jesus. No, no spoiler alert, sorry.
I was thinking that it was like literally within 5 seconds of you coming on air, you had blown the whole thing for people who were just waking up.
But the whole point of this is that we're telling you what happened overnight in case you missed it.
I would agree.
What are you going to do? Watch the... I suppose you could watch the 14-minute highlights.
I'm also sure that he's not even referring to the match. He's just referring to the halftime show and how he spoils the 50 cent thing. Because that's you want to come to that with a degree of surprise.
Imagine if you're 50, though, and you've put all this time and effort and, like, political and social capital into getting back in and to be a member of the gang, and you've got this cool move that you're like, no bro, I'm going to do this move, I have to, it's like, this is my big chance, and the camera pans over to the one of the dancers and misses it. You're like,
wait,
what?
You know he's playing Dublin later this year.
Alright, so
are you more or less tempted to go
let's
after
get him on the phone?
Yeah, let's get him on the phone.
Come
as well
on, that's our excuse. Yeah,
get him in studio.
I take back my bit earlier on when I said you're like completely overrated. I've changed my tune on that one.
Do not watch back OTBAM on the 14th of February 2022. We slaughtered you.
Brian Dillon says, lads, that pass interference call, absolute shambles. Also, I'm too old to be staying up and working today. If I milk half the cows this morning, it'll be a miracle. Maybe if you half milk all of them, that'll be fine. Good luck with that, Brian.
Oh, right. Like, I mean, that's one. It's one thing coming in and sitting at a desk and talking nonsense after that, but to actually get up and do physical work after staying up all night, that is next level stuff. Fair play.
Everybody knows that we couldn't get up and do physical stuff anyway, Owen. Irrespective of whether or not we were up all night last night. Look at these
point.
Beautiful uncalloused hands that we have. Where are we starting?
We start with the rugby, and Ireland's decision making has got to go in the red, and it's been a big talking point, I think, after Saturday night. There's a lot of different ways we can go with this, but I guess if we start at the decision itself to go for the post rather than going for the corner in a game that would have been a fairly important staging post that Ireland actually got the job done, because France were pretty good. Did you put it as a coming out party for France this year, Six Nations? Kind of definitely felt like this was a significant moment for them at the weekend, a really big win for them, and Ireland had an opportunity to set them back a little bit in that, which could prove to be significant in 12, 18 months' time. So we're not sure how that's going to play out on that front, but in the here and now, I think the big talking point will be around that decision, something that the Ireland camp are saying that they got right.
So just to... I didn't see the on-field interviews with the captain and with Carberry, who made the decision, but it felt a little bit like there was uncertainty there, because it wasn't just the two of them. Henderson was walking up. O'Mahony was there.
Yeah.
It was like a horse designed by committee is a camel. And, like, in fairness, one thing we should start, the Joey Carby's kicking metronomic. It's like every time he stands over, you're like, he's going to kick this. Is there a world in which, so they've defended this by saying we did have another opportunity. They had two more opportunities. It's the subsequent decision making which is also really bad that highlights how bad this is. Because there's a, like, they get the ball back. It's just they're deep in French territory. Mm. And they do get another opportunity, but they blow it.
Yeah. So does that vindicate the decision?
I don't know.
It's actually the decision making on the second instance, which is the worst. But see, the thing is, what you want is, if you get that opportunity and you're in French territory, it would be better to be in French territory with a lead than to be chasing another 3 points, right? Or to be chasing what should realistically be 4 points, which is a wrong number. Like, because I can't imagine that Ireland were playing for the draw. I can't imagine that if they got, you know, if they were in that moment in the end, of course they would take the 3 points if you've only got a couple of minutes left for the draw. But at the outset, they should have been thinking, how do we win this game, rather than how do we draw this game? And that was the only way they could have been thinking when they were going for that 3 points, I would suggest. Also, as well, when you add into the mix the fact that they were on 3 tries at that point, that's an added little sweetener to get another one. Not that you needed one. I think the win should be enough.
Well, you know, you're guaranteeing yourself a second losing bonus point, or at least one losing bonus point, if they score miraculously 8 points in the next while. I look, a couple of things strike me. The famous decision that England made when Lancaster was coach, where there was just like not clear thinking. It happened in a World Cup,
yeah,
because the players didn't have the experience. So I'm kind of the view that if this is a mistake and they decide what the future, what will happen, who will make the call, how the call will be made, who has ultimate responsibility for it. Because you heard Gavin Comiskey making the point to you yesterday in the papers that, you know, that's the out-halves decision. It's sometimes, though, the captain, if he's the forward, if he doesn't have faith in the line-out and the line-out's gone creaky, then he's like, look, you're just going to take this and we've got you, don't worry. Like,
yeah.
But afterwards, just to say, bulletproof, like, that's what they have to do. They have to defend themselves.
We had this conversation recently about Jack Crowley from Munster in that game against Cash, and about whether or not Jack Crowley should have been the man with the responsibility to go for the post or to go for the corner, given he was a rookie essentially at that level, European wise. Got to remember that this is also Joey Carberry's first start. Granted, he's picked up a hell of a lot of experience throughout his 5 or 6 years in professional rugby so far already, but still, these are significant moments in Joey Carberry's understanding of big games, right? So, like, I think that they're not poles apart, these two situations.
No, I can understand why they did it. And I think that if they had managed to get the ball back again and do something with it, as opposed to getting the ball back and not doing something with it, we would be like, oh, what a great decision that was, because kept the scoreboard ticking over. Like, there's a bit of scoreboard journalism going on in the aftermath of it. But I think that bit of the decision-making, they can defend it. That's fair enough. But what happened afterwards is bad. Like, it was just bad. We end up with the forward pass. We end up with handling errors. We end up not putting France under the type of pressure that we were putting them under in that second half when we were making our furious comeback.
Yeah, and part of that process was, on the decision-making front, was taking Joey Carberry out of there and putting Jack Carty in there. And that's not a slight in Jack Carty whatsoever. It's to do with the fact that you're being thrown in at a pretty awkward time. I presume, as somebody who's going to be playing that pass, which ends up going forward, you kind of want a few more minutes under your belt. You want to feel your way into the game a little bit, but you're thrown right into a really, really sticky situation immediately. And maybe they figured that Carberry wasn't going to be able to play 80 beforehand, but that feels like a premeditated. That's true.
I mean,
but I feel, you know, like that would have been a strange premeditated decision, wouldn't it, to take somebody off after 78 minutes? That'd be a very weird number to come up with. But if it was premeditated in the first place, that's obviously not good. Your in-game management needs to be in-game, not premeditated. But while this is open to criticism, I really believe that it was a bad call. This is not to say that this can't be good in the long run. And when you talk about scoreboard journalism there, scoreboard journalism will go 10 times this magnitude if this happens in a World Cup, because that is literally all that matters. And all that matters is you win or you lose, and you're in or you're out when it comes to the knockout stages of a World Cup. So that's the context, I think, that's informing this.
Let's hear from Andy Farrell and James Ryan here on the decision to kick.
Just felt like it was the right decision at the time. I think we were imposing our game on them at that period. We felt confident in our attack, and we thought we'd bring the game to 3 points. And I think we backed ourselves to go win the game then, off the back of that.
It's the right decision. There's no doubt about that. They feel the game. They're in the moment. They understand what's happening. There was plenty of time left. In fact, didn't we have a line out after that to go on when there was a couple of points down, because we got the 3 points back. We had a line out and an opportunity to score the try, and we didn't. And that's the game. So I back them to make those calls.
Yeah, okay. So look, that I think is a big opportunity. And I think this is exactly why we needed not to play Sexton in every game, because we don't know what they'll do the next time. But we do know that they now have some video evidence where they're like, okay, let's just kick for the corner next time. Or let's make sure we don't kick for the corner the next time. But when we do, in the final 3 minutes, that we're far more clinical than we were then.
And look, it's interesting that you made the comparison between this and the Wales-England game in 2015. What England did in the aftermath of that, and the wider scale of the disaster, was to throw the baby out with the bathwater with significant effect. The good news for Ireland is that they don't have the luxury of doing that. They don't have a pool of players to step in. But not that that's what they should do anyway.
No, it's the opposite of that. It's actually give these guys again the opportunity to get into it. Like, I was just thinking overnight, what's the team going to be for the Italy game? Like, I would make a swathe of changes. Anybody who's in the squad starts. I would start Carberry, and I would probably start Gibson Park so that they can build a bit of a partnership, and you start Henshaw and you start Coombs and you bring back Herring, and it's a completely different team, and so everybody has a little time to rest up in advance of the final push for the two big games, and there's still a championship there for them this year. And if they don't get the championship, then they better feel the pain of not getting a championship and just how narrow the margins are in these big games and learn from it. Like, I think this is much better for us than... I still see people in the papers saying, oh, Ireland are the best front row in the world. I think we don't. We don't have the best front row in the world. We need to stop saying that we're the best at this and the best at that. We lost the game at the weekend, and that's okay. But let's not get to the point where it's like blind faith.
Do we have the best rugby-playing front row in the world,
though? I mean, Owen, how do you know, right? Does that not include scrums? We were under pressure in the scrums. We were giving away penalties.
Scrums, like, definitely take place.
And their big lads were so big that they were stopping our big lads, smashing them back at various stages. Like, it's okay not to have the best front row in the world. It's okay for us to realise that actually the shite that we were talking after the Wales game in some cases was just shite. And that's fine.
But do you not see Dan Sheehan's performance? That's the
Dan
best
Sheehan
hooker
is
in the world.
Class. He is great. It's really exciting. You do need Ronan Kelleher and Dan Sheehan both to be fit, because like that impact off the bench in those final 20 minutes could have been the difference between victory and defeat. And I'm very excited about it. And I think Porter has massive potential still over the next couple of years. With Furlong, I would be like, we might just put you on ice until the World Cup now because you're so good. Mm. We just want to make sure that you're going to be fully fit. You go off and you farm for a little while. Take the year off. That's what I would be doing. Like, instead, he's going to play every minute of every game, the three tests down under against the All Blacks, and every minute in November series. And then this time next year, he'll just be creaking and be like...
I think November will be an interesting one. I think maybe the All Blacks in the summer will be a really good test.
Who starts the tests at out half?
I would be leaning towards definitely starting Carberry in one of them.
Which one? I think all three. If he's fit, all three, and put Sexton on the bench if he's fit.
I think you start Carberry in test one.
Now, Joe Schmidt did do that in Australia, in fairness to him.
Yeah.
And that tour where Schmidt's always accused of not trying stuff out, but he did try stuff out on that tour a bit. It's just our style didn't evolve or develop. If Sexton is fit for the Italy game and wants to play, we're like, yeah, okay, you can play 20 minutes at the end.
Mm.
But actually, maybe not. Maybe you pick Carty for that game.
Maybe. It's interesting. On Carberry, obviously, there's been a lot of really glowing stuff written about him over the last couple of days. At half time, when I was looking at the scoreboard and looking at the performance, I was like, I really wish Sexton was out there. Like, I wasn't blown away at all by the performance. At full time, though, things have changed a good bit, I thought. I thought, like, maybe this is scoreboard journalism looking, because Ireland won the second half. Maybe that informs my view of Carberry in the second half. But I definitely felt he was better in the second half than the first half. It almost as if he had realised this is what the standard is, and that intense pace of starting a test match in Saint-Denis was to that level almost.
And our forwards stopped being completely annihilated by their big forwards. Big men are
very big.
I definitely also felt like there's kind of this weird underrating of France going on still, where they have all the best parts of the South African game plan in terms of the brute force and the sheer energy that you will face when you go up against them, but they still have all the best parts of the traditional French style of rugby, with unbelievable soft hands, incredible runners from deep, a goal kicking fullback, of course they do, and
the best player in the world.
Yeah, who can still get better? Like, I thought that it was a great game. Ireland played very well for a patch, got smacked in the mouth early on, and came back briefly, but then got smacked in the mouth again. You know, we definitely went. We were facing Mike Tyson in the first half, peak Mike Tyson, not Buster Douglas Mike Tyson, and didn't have anything really to do to answer that. So that's a very good, important experience for the team.
are you looking at the Mack Hansen try then in the first half and saying to yourself, that's very much a sort of freak incident, or fair play for actually finding a way of getting sustainably punched in the mouth?
Well, it's like brilliant opportunism, but also you're not going to, that's not going to happen again to us, right?
No.
So it's like, it's not a fluke, because that would be to completely devalue the hard work and the effort and the incredible execution. But you're unlikely to be able to score that again. The Maul try from the line out was good. Like that seemed interesting for us to be able to find space right there. And I thought our hands were terrible in various stages. Like people were making mistakes. So there's room for improvement. Like that you can go, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. These penalties, that, like the difference was we outscored them in terms of tries. The difference was that they were putting so much pressure on us that we were giving away penalties. Fixable, you would suggest? Like history would show that we get better at that kind of stuff. Like there's a period of time where we have a few games where we give away a load of penalties. They go off and they do incredible amounts of work on it. Certainly the Schmidt era, we would have had periods where we were giving away loads of penalties and then it stopped. So this is the time to be having these, as opposed to smashing France and going, oh, we've got the best front row in the world and the best second row and the best, well, the best back row, clearly.
But like, I mean, that's just like, would that not just have been bluster anyway? Like, do you think that the camp actually believes that? Do you think that's an actual factor in how they behave?
I think it's no harm running into that French juggernaut and going, okay, that's the standard. Mm. Let's get there. Okay. Move on from rugby now.
Is that a commenter or is that Tommy Rooney? Or is it both? Is he just in the YouTube comments, TR93 or something, being like, please move off rugby? We're moving on to Premier League because the top four race. I've been forced to put this into the red this morning, even though this is a bona fide green talking point.
But you mean Man United are in red?
West Ham are kind of.
Tottenham Hotspur Spurs are in red.
Yeah. Wolves and Arsenal are in green, so therefore maybe this should fit into the amber, where it's going to be wacky races between now and the end of the season. Chelsea could potentially get sucked into it. Who knows? They're all looking up at Chelsea. Chelsea's struggling and limping to a Club World Cup win. Tommy Tuchel, what he once was.
Does Abramovich celebrate a World Club Cup win? Is that like the ultimate? He thinks that's the best.
For sure. His yacht at the weekend would have been the place to be.
Yeah.
Roman Abramovich has now won it all.
Permanently lit.
Did they win? Did Di Matteo win the Club World Cup for
Chelsea? I don't think so.
Funnily enough,
that's why he didn't last.
That's true enough.
I don't know, to be honest. I stopped paying attention to it when it became the format that it is now.
Oh, there was once upon a time when he did.
It was good. It was good once upon a time. Okay. It was like South America champions versus European champions, away we go.
Yeah, that would probably be a smarter way of doing it. But yeah, maybe Chelsea, they get carried away with their success at the weekend and they get dragged into it as well, which would just make this thing even better. If not, who cares? It's already a bloody good race at the moment. Manchester United setting the tone on Saturday and Tottenham being like, hold my beer on Sunday. And even despite that defeat for Tottenham against Wolves yesterday, you still look at the table and mathematically you're thinking, I kind of fancy Spurs here if they put a run together. That's what you can say about all of these teams.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you can. And you can, I mean, is it too late for Newcastle to make a push for fourth?
It's like, possibly not.
Their current form seems to be pretty good.
Like you were talking optimistically about Aston Villa a few weeks ago.
And the points they've dropped since has just been disastrous.
And if they hadn't dropped those points, I know, if my wife had, whatever, you know. my aunt.
Right.
Wrong analogy.
I like this Owen on no sleep thing.
Where was I? The Premier League, yeah, the top four is interesting. We're going to be chatting to Andy Midden later on about Manchester United and one of the factors that has like made this top four thing very intriguing and very exciting and very suspenseful is the fact that Manchester United have let themselves down and they've let their fans down, because they were the team that were supposed to push for the title.
Well, they keep getting worse and worse.
That's the thing. Like, pre-season, you might be saying to yourself, right, they're clearly just a little bit off the top three. They signed Ronaldo from under Manchester City's nose. You're like, okay, this is title challenging stuff now, the squad that they've had. So you'd have to say that it's been
a disaster.
Close enough to a disaster of the season. Like, given the level that they are currently operating at.
The only thing we're missing is a central midfielder, but sure, Pogba, he can step up. And maybe McTominay can make the leap. Everybody thinks he's really good. And it's like, no, you're like drawing with Burnley. in a game that maybe could have gone either way, drawing with Southampton in a game that could have gone either way. Alan Shearer's just a headline on his Athletic piece. He's become a really good columnist, actually, which was an unexpected late-stage blooming of Alan Shearer. Manchester United have become a leaky, noisy, messy club who give their players an excuse to fail. And there was a line about it. How could you expect anything else from a club that's so badly run? It's like, this is mad. The players have said that they want Pochettino. But the players don't like what Ranić is doing. And Pochettino's going to be worse. He's cancelled bacon buddies. He can't have bacon sandwiches.
Also as well, it is a strange scenario where we're talking about what the players want and how we all know that this is what the players want, as if there's like some sort of as if somebody from Sky Sports News has gone in and interviewed all the players as part of a Vox Pop or something. Like, we're getting a constant stream of information from inside the club about
somebody's on the WhatsApp group.
Yeah,
like accidentally, because they, you know, make everybody an admin, fine, fair enough. Suddenly, like, we're all watching the WhatsApp group gone. Is that the real Ronaldo, or is that somebody pretending to be Ronaldo?
Maybe all this information that's coming out is just completely false, and somebody in that WhatsApp group is trying to flush out the reporter in Agatha Christie form or something like that. Like, Mark Critchley's got a good piece this morning, which is carried in the Irish Independent, about Ronaldo, and he asks the question, you know, if Ronaldo's not scoring goals, then really the question is, what is the point of Ronaldo and his role in that team? It's his longest barren spell in front of goal in 13 years at this point. It's only 6 games, which I guess shows the standard that he reached over the last little while. So his current stats, he's 0.53 goals per game in all competitions. That's down from 0.81 per game at Juventus last season, 0.4 goals per game in Premier League compared to 0.87 in Serie A last season. Granted, it's a different league, but it is a nosedive compared to last year. Fewer shots per game, expected goals is down, but his pressures and his volume of pressures is up under Ranić. So it's almost flipped in terms of how the narrative around Ronaldo was before Christmas, where, you know, he's scoring goals but he's not doing much else. Now he's doing a bit of the other stuff and he's not scoring goals, and the screenshots of that miss against Southampton on Saturday afternoon don't paint a pretty picture whatsoever.
We'll come back to this a little bit later and with Andy Mitten, and we'll talk about the rest of the other teams who are bidding for the top four. Our resident Spurs fan seems to have gone a little bit quiet in recent days, but if you're out there, we'd love to hear from you if you're our Spurs fans. Like, what the hell's going on? Let's move on to Limerick Hurling in the amber. Why are they in the amber?
Well, I don't think they're anywhere near dead. Like, why would we? Like, we can put them in the red for sure. I mean, like, it's not a good performance. It wasn't a good weekend for Limerick. I don't think you can paint it as a good weekend. They're beyond the point of, you know, needing a wake up call. They're too good to need a wake up call. 27 points to 118 was the full-time score on Saturday night. What was probably most surprising was, like, 5 minutes into the game, Limerick were up 1-1 to no score, and there was a sense of the inevitable about what they were going to do. They obviously get a red card in the game, and maybe that's a suggestion that their flirtation with the line has just gone over the line a little bit. That you're going to get back.
Remember the league last year? They got involved in scraps in every game. Yeah. Game on game on game on game, they got involved in scraps. And
they fixed it.
Well, I think Don Logue said in the telly that the one caveat you'd have about this Limerick team is their discipline. And, you know, what would have happened if Galana got the line like he should have when Tip were 8, 9, 10 points up last year in the Munster final? It would have been very interesting to see what would have happened. I don't know. I still think there's a good chance that they come back. But you don't know, like,
I think it's more than a good chance to come back. I'm very confident.
14 men. It's, you know, it's easy. It's easy for them not to come back from that position. And yeah, like, you would have to say he's an important player. So,
Maybe Limerick have just lost something. Maybe Paul Knerk has lost his superpowers without the water break. Maybe that's what's after happening here. That once you take that away from them, that's their secret weapon gone.
I think they'll be pretty happy with that, right?
Every chance.
The one thing I would say is that I'm like constantly reminded last year in the league when Cork put out kind of a second string or a below par team against Limerick and then never got the opportunity to see what their full team would do against Limerick and didn't beat them in the league, and then you roll into the championship and they get destroyed. Eventually that's what it ends up in. You didn't have that opportunity to just, if Limerick had beaten Galway, what they've given Galway is life. Galway's buzzing now. They have Shefflin, their first big test. They come back from that. Physically, they stand up to everything. You know, they are the one who knocks this week. They have no doubts.
Yeah. Would you describe Galway as a sucker who were given an even break at the weekend?
Exactly.
Potentially. I think that one of the valid criticisms I thought last weekend around Limerick were people saying, where is the next bunch of players going to come from? How strong is their depth as the year goes on? And like, I think that would be a concern for them. But at the same time, you look at someone like Cathal O'Neill.
Well, that's it.
He scored 4 points from play and he was...
in at 11. So like, he can... So Keane Lynch goes to midfield. You've got him. They've got... Yeah, it's like... And the main caveat is this is the best hurler in the country who isn't playing for them at the moment.
Exactly.
Because he's got a progressive manager who understands that Keane Lynch playing there gives an opportunity to blood somebody else. Like, you'd have to say that... they are one of the best managed and best run teams. And look, even the red cards, I mean, it's in a schmozzle. There's a stray stick. Gerard Hegarty's going to miss a game. They'll be all right.
Do you think that there's a conversation around Limerick because there is a conversation around Dublin? Do you think that it's like on vogue right now, the fall of Empire?
I don't think there's any conversation about the fall of Limerick, though.
No, I don't. Like, see, that's what I'm... like, I mean, not just trying to make the point here that everything is fine with Limerick. Like, I guess, show me the person who's actually saying that Limerick are finished and I'd probably struggle to show you who that person is. But I don't know. I wouldn't be worried about Limerick whatsoever.
No. They're in the amber because there's at least some hope that we're going to have a good hurling championship. That there might be some close games. Every game won't be a blowout. That's what I hope.
And also, I mean, the Munster hurling championship will throw up something here and there. It's nice and early as well. It's the best competition we have in Irish sport potentially. So, hopefully Limerick get a couple of tough games there.
Edward Freeman says, at the game you could see Carberry was cramping up at the end and that's why Farrell had to take him off. That's fair enough. If he was cramping, you got to go. That's fair enough. Dahi O'Shock6 says, the penalty kick was the right call with an unsure line out, guaranteeing the losing bonus point at least could be the difference in the final Six Nations table. I mean, look, you know, if they end up winning the tournament on the basis of the losing bonus point, then people will be like, yeah, okay, there's a point to that.
100%. And the shaky line-out is also a reasonable point. It didn't... what was interesting is just that the Ireland camp were very certain in the aftermath that they were definitely like, this was 100% the correct call, fully backed the players and all that.
Yeah.
You got to say that, I guess.
Yeah. And maybe that's the right thing to do. Like, I fully backed the players. And on Tuesday in the video session, we'll go through the scenarios and the next time this happens, maybe they'll make a different decision. Who knows?
Yeah. Possibly. Yeah, I mean,
green.
The green. LA Rams, first up in the green. I mean, like, when you look back at what they did to get to this point, to actually get over the line, I'm not sure how much of an impact the Super Bowl being at home had for them, but it did feel that when we're kind of looking back on the story of it, it'll be like the LA Rams targeted the Super Bowl that was going to take place in Los Angeles, and the whole thing worked out. And it just ties the whole story together. Maybe... in a neater way than the reality is. But there was definitely a couple of gambles that makes this look like a franchise that was in a hurry. Like hiring McVay at the age of 30 in 2017, the youngest ever Super Bowl winning coach at this point now. John Gruden and Mike Tomlin, the only other people in their 30s to have done this. Trading the two first round picks for Jalen Ramsey in 2019. Pretty ballsy decision, you'd have to say. You'd have to say picking up Odell Beckham Jr. this season.
Absolutely brilliant.
Baldy.
Oh no, I think it was brilliant. Like, why was everybody else not going after Odell Beckham Jr.? Because he's had a bad time in Cleveland. Cleveland's a shit show. Go and get him.
Mm.
And so he goes off. It looks like he might have done his ACL on the turf.
Didn't look good.
It was one of those non-contact knee injuries. So you hope he's okay. But like, he's basically scored a touchdown in all of the big games towards the end of the season. First few weeks, not great. Learned the offense. Became a team player. Took a tiny bit of attention off the best player in the game on the offensive side at the moment in Cooper Kupp, who, when the game is on the line, they get the ball back with about 6.5 minutes to go after a fairly horrific drop from Boyd, and he just goes Cooper Kupp. So there's actually a 4th and 1. They need a yard to keep the drive alive, and they do an end around to Cooper Kupp, and he makes 7 or 8 yards, and then he just keeps going back Cooper Kupp, Cooper Kupp, Cooper Kupp, Cooper Kupp, and then Cooper Kupp ends up getting a pass interference, which wasn't really a pass interference. It was a horrific decision, it looks like.
And then bench for the face guard.
And then they throw a touchdown pass to him, which gets wiped off. And then they throw another touchdown pass to him, where poor Eli Apple, who's been the butt of a joke for a long period of time, is now forever going to be in the highlight reel. That is, like, this is the moment the game was won and lost.
Yeah. And of course, when we talk about the decision-making process in this team, going for Matt Stafford and getting rid of Jared Goff, in hindsight, obviously a genius move. At the time, possibly didn't look like this was going to be the move that would get a team to the Super Bowl. And that was because of Stafford's attachment to the Detroit Lions. And I mean, when you're attached to the Detroit Lions, you're going to be the butt of a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
Obviously, very highly paid man throughout his entire career. But it does feel that there's been a couple of storylines that have resulted in Super Bowl wins over the last little while that have just been great vindication stories. And the Matt Stafford one is definitely one of those.
Yeah, we should talk about Aaron Donald briefly as well. He's like the best player in American football at the moment, the most dominant defender. He just turned 30, I think. And they were talking to him about retirement afterwards. That story's been floating around. And he says, oh, I'm just going to live in the moment right now. Maybe that's him saying to Stan Kroenke, who is the owner of Arsenal and the owner of the Rams, I've just won you a Super Bowl. I might retire. What would happen if I retired? This team would basically implode.
Yeah.
Double. Pay me.
That's possible.
That might be going on. I don't know.
I mean,
because you could easily play 34, 35, you know?
Absolutely. Obviously, his position means that
Pick up another $30 million a
year. Yeah. I mean, he's been in the league since, what, 2014 at this point? I mean, retiring at the peak is a tough thing to do. And they obviously had their disappointment in 2018. And now to actually taste that sweet success for the Kroenke family and to walk away from it all is a tricky thing. But, for somebody in his position and the attrition rate and all that, I wouldn't be surprised if he actually did do it.
Are you jealous of the Rams and the money they spend and the success they have under the careful stewardship of the Kroenke family?
Well, I mean, we deal in cold, hard facts in this show, so show me who's spent more money than anybody else in last summer in the Premier League than Arsenal. No one is the answer. Well, actually, it's more like Stan kind of does the operation. I'm not saying this is the truth. It feels like Stan does the operation in Los Angeles, and Josh's unwanted son just does the operation in Arsenal.
You can run this thing we're not that into. Okay, the last green, obviously.
The last green, obviously, is the All-Ireland Club Finals. Sorry. These two conclusions were bonkers. Absolutely bonkers. The Kilmacud game, we were previewing it on Friday, and I think there was a general consensus that this may not be the prettiest game on the eye, and that's kind of what happened. But just because the game's not pretty on the eye doesn't mean that it doesn't leave itself open to absolutely ridiculous drama. And at the very end of extra time, Kilku get over the line and get their All-Ireland win with the last kick of the game, which made the afternoon even more extraordinary because it came from a fairly extraordinary place with Ballygunner's last gasp goal, a last gasp screamer of a goal
from about 40 yards.
Paul Flynn-esque.
Why even try it from there? Oh my god, what? It's sensational.
Oh, and for it to come against TJ Reid and Ballyhale after what they had done to St. Thomas's in the All-Ireland semi-final was absolutely incredible. And we have, I guess, three crazy moments in the conclusion of this year's All-Irelands, from TJ Reid to the two late goals on Saturday. And that's what people are going to remember these competitions by. It's going to be really interesting to see if moments like that have a transferable impact on the interest in this competition, because this competition now has a new stage and it's got potential for a lot more eyeballs on it.
Yeah, it was up against a Six Nations game this weekend.
Yeah.
You can't, it's hard to judge, but it didn't register as much as it should have done. And when it ends up being in December, will it be this year? Will it be next year? What's the massive fixtures? How long does it take for the split season to fully work? So eventually it's going to end up, it'll be in winter. And maybe because it's the only thing that's on at that period, it will get more pop. It's hard to know. But for Kilku and for Mickey Moore and for him to get his All-Ireland, he was in the backroom team, the coach of the Derry team that won the All-Ireland in the 90s. So that's the various Ulster teams who have reached All-Ireland semi-finals and finals in recent years, he's had a hand with Slough Neil, and it's just a sensational achievement for him. And it is like a proper end to, or a proper exclamation point on an incredible career. So it's funny because you very rarely hear players so stridently express their admiration for a manager in the aftermath of a team when he'd beaten his own club on the way to this.
Yeah.
So I thought that was amazing. Just fair play to them.
Yeah, like, and if we're looking at what a sport needs to do to kind of get to the next level, it's like, how can a sport be consumed on social media? Well, having two unbelievable moments that can be distilled down. And somebody matched the WLR commentary onto the Tichy Cahir pictures from the weekend as well, and it was just magic. So they've definitely ticked that box. If you want to try and get new viewers, well, go viral is one way of doing it.
And have superpowers, have juggernauts be derailed. Like,
doesn't hurt.
Have the sacred cows be slaughtered live on TV in dramatic fashion. That's class.
Well, I guess it was two sacred cows, I would argue. I think we actually went 50-50 on Ballygun or Ballyhale on our quick picks on Friday. Don't mean to brag, but...
So Ballyhale and Croke's going down, the super clubs.
Yeah. I think we all picked Kilku as well, though, I think, on Friday. Yeah, I don't think these were two surprises at all. I think the hurling was a bigger surprise, but even that wasn't a shock.
Right.
Or close to it.
That is this week's performance rankings.
OTBAN's performance rankings with Gillette.
I'm reliably informed here. Adrian Barry stuck by his local parish, of course.
He's
the senior manager of the under sixes. he's appointed himself chief grand poobah.
He wears a Bose headset on the side of his under six training.
OTBAN brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. If you want to get in on some hot, hot, hot performance rankings action, then tell us who you think should be in the green, who you think should be in the red, who you think should be in amber, and you'll be in the draw for a Gillette starter pack. We'll tell you who won that a little bit later on. Up next, we're going to hear from Andy Mitten. We've got Alan Quinlan. We've got Kieran Carey, and Super Bowl reactions still to come. Keep your thoughts and comments rolling in. We'll get to them next.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.